Well, Potties and Gladdies, in these days of economic crisis, invoking the name Warren Buffett has a kind of talismanic quality that bestows economic credibility on all who utter it. Both presidential candidates have mentioned him as a possible Treasury Secretary, although he has endorsed Obama and tends to be very rude about McCain. And in the last presidential debate, Obama said Buffett will be an economic advisor. Earlier this year, the so-called Sage of Omaha, now 78 years old, who still lives in the modest suburban home he bought in the 1960s, I think he's avoided foreclosure, he knocked Bill Gates off the top of the list of the world's richest people. His personal wealth, when we last counted, is valued somewhere between $58 and $62 billion, which, put another way, is somewhere between a squillion and a zillion. He predicted the financial meltdown, once told a reporter, ultimately, Wall Street will be eliminated. But he personally bailed out investment banking firm Goldman Sachs and is currently urging confidence in the US markets. Now is a great time to buy, according to Warren. Not noted in the past for largesse or philanthropy, and I found this particularly interesting. In 2006, he announced a plan to gradually give away his fortune to charity, with 83% of it going to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Now, that's very self-effacing, isn't it? There have been countless books written about his investing strategies, but little on his life, influences, or what makes him tick. And my next guest, Alice Schroeder, has written the only authorised biography of Buffett, spent 5 years at it, and over 2,000 hours talking to him. Her book is called The Snowball, Warren Buffett and the Business of Life, and Alice joins us from San Francisco. Welcome, Alice.
Thank you.
Was there any time when the family were known as Buffet?
Perhaps in France, which was their country of origin, but not in the United States.
I wonder why.
They do have some interesting eating habits, so I don't know.
No, I'm just thinking that anything that smacks of the French has in recent decades been a bit unpopular in the U.S. You got to know him when you were an analyst at Morgan Stanley.
That's right. I was the only analyst who followed Berkshire Hathaway stock.
What do you mean you followed it? You sat there every day at your desk worrying about it, keeping track of it, taking its temperature?
I just watched the ticker go up and down. No, I was the only person who tried to figure out its value and decide whether it was to whether you would buy it or sell it, and then I published research.
And you got to know him pretty well because you were on the blow with him every other day.
Yeah, you know, I talked to him fairly regularly. I didn't want to abuse the privilege, so I didn't talk to him, you know, that often, but often enough, and nobody else did.
I take it that he exudes self-confidence.
In business, he is absolutely self-confident, and in his personal life, not at all. So there's this strange dichotomy.
But that's not unusual amongst tycoons. I've known a few, and I would make exactly the same observation. You know, the on-stage performance and the backstage performances are utterly different. Now, you wrote this book with his permission.
Yes, he cooperated with me and spent a lot of time and allowed me to see his files, everything.
Would you tell the listener that wonderful line that he gave you about diverging versions of his life?
He told me that if his version differed from anyone else's, I should use the story that was the less flattering version.
And did you do that?
I did, and in fact, in a few cases, I actually put his version in the book and then disagreed with it.
Well, 550 authors have written about the bloke. You had this unprecedented access, but I'm still amazed that he found the time to spend 2,000 hours chatting with you.
Well, over 5 years, it seems like a lot of time. We actually spent much of that time with him working and me observing him, which was very enlightening in and of itself. I have about 300 hours of recorded interviews, and I got to just spend time figuring him out.
Was he fatherly or flirtatious or a bit of both?
Neither. He's actually someone who evokes a protective instinct in almost everyone that comes into contact with him. He brings out the motherly side in women. He's not the least bit flirtatious, and he's not the least bit fatherly. He's like a kid.
He's notable amongst the super rich because of, well, not so much modest as miserly lifestyle and spending habits. Tell us a bit about them.
Well, you know, he's gotten better in recent years, but when he was younger, it really pained him if he couldn't get change for a quarter or just spend money on a 10-cent phone call. And his children said that if he took them to the movies, he might buy the tickets, but they couldn't count on him paying for the popcorn. You know, he's just always had a terrible time letting go of money.
He could have built mansions in Beverly Hills or, you know, down to Trump Towers. He could have bought Trump Towers, for heaven's sake, in New York, but he didn't.
No, and, you know, the line that everyone uses is that he's lived in the same house since 1958. But, you know, if you saw the house, it's a moderate, you know, typical middle-class house, but it hasn't been redecorated in decades, and it's fairly shabby, but he just doesn't notice these things.
It's a very strange thing.
Warren's daughter, Susie Jr., buys his cars for him once every decade when he will be persuaded he must have a new car. And she has to shop in every adjacent county to find a cheap enough car. And one year she actually had to buy a car that had been damaged by hail to get the price down to where he would be willing to pay for it.
With his money, he could arrange the hail, I would have thought.
Yes, and
he just points at the skies and it would.
He does fly by private jet. That's his one indulgence. It's really the only one. But he says he likes to work cheap and travel expensive.
What's the story about free T-shirts?
You know, it's really funny. He loves anything free that's a gift. If he goes to a conference, he loves the free golf shirt or bag that you get. I have a dinner every year where we do a kind of a talk show style interview, and I interview him for guests. And 2 years ago, I gave out free golf shirts, and he sat there clutching his on his lap for an hour while he answered questions, and it was so funny. He loves anything free.
I don't think he'd be wearing Vote One McCain T-shirts, no matter how free they were, would he?
You know, he always stresses that he has known John McCain for a long time and admires him, but he is very liberal and he is truly an Obama supporter.
Didn't he say something when asked, was it by you or another, what would it take to have him vote for McCain? He said a frontal lobotomy.
Well, yeah. He's quite eager to have a change in regime, yes.
Oh dear. Now, if he doesn't spend money, what does he see as its significance in his life?
Well, there's a couple of things. One is that he's a collector. He's collected coins and stamps and all kinds of things, and the money is a sort of collection to him. He likes amassing it. He really has no interest in letting go of it because that would diminish his collection.
So he sounds a bit like Uncle Scrooge, who had silos full of money, and he used to sit in it and throw it up and let it hit him on the head.
Well, you know, Warren once invested in silver, and, you know, my friend Sharon Osbourne, who was his bridge partner, witnessed a conversation with him where he wanted to go visit the silver. It was in a vault, and he wanted to visit it.
Oh, dear. I warmed to him. He's funny.
But the money means something else to him, too. You know, his success as an investor has been challenged over and over as the product of luck or as some kind of fluke. And the fact that after more than 50 years, he is the richest man in the world and got there without any gimmickry or chicanery or taking on a lot of debt or anything like that, it is evidence that he was right and that his methods were correct. And I think that means something.
But if you look at the Australian tycoons, Packer or the Packers or the Murdochs, there was inherited wealth. So tell us about his dad. His father was a stockbroker.
Yes, his father was a stockbroker who became a Republican congressman. Warren was sitting in his father's office very early reading books. He actually asked for a book on bond salesmanship for his 7th birthday, which was unusual behavior for a child. And Warren's father was a very rigid man. He was very right-wing, very conservative, to the point where he just didn't have any flexibility in his ideas at all. And when he was young, Warren followed along with those beliefs.
I'm having a lovely chat with Alice Schroeder, author of The Snowball, Warren Buffet and the Business of Life. And this is LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, downloadable onto your pod. Okay, so when he's 6, he starts selling chewing gum door to door. That's a sticky business.
Yes, and it became so for him because he showed at a very early age this total inflexibility of attitude toward his customers that would characterize him all his life. He still remembers to this day a customer named Virginia McCoubrey who wanted to buy one stick of gum, and he said, "I've got my principles. We don't break up packs of gum." She wanted to spend a penny, and they were a nickel, and this irritates him even now,
so
70 years later.
So it bloody well should. And I like your story that when he was when he was 14, he put in his first tax return and he deducted his bicycle as a work-related expense.
Which he says was questionable, but at the time he was engaging in a number of behaviors that were questionable and he was something of a delinquent, so that was par for the course. He was shoplifting. He stole his sister's bicycle.
Oh, did he now? Did he?
Yes.
He was a shoplifter.
He stole, he went to Sears Roebuck when he was 14 and he stole hundreds of golf balls. He was angry at his parents for making him move to Washington, so that was his response.
Okay, in high school, he and a friend spend $25 and they purchase a used pinball machine.
They did, and they put it in a barber shop, told the barber that they would split the profits with him. They came back that night, and there were $4. And so that was a lot of return for a $25 pinball machine.
And so he finishes up owning three of them.
Yes, and he just kept putting pinball machines in barber shops. And the idea was that the profits from one machine would pay for the next, which was a concept he used in business through a whole lifelong series of investments.
We're talking to Alice, and Alice is telling us about Warren, who got bad grades in high school, I understand.
He got bad grades in math and history and all the classes that should be subjects he did really well in, but, you know, he always was someone who was self-taught. He was not somebody who was an academic star.
Going back to his dad, you tell us that sitting above his desk, staring out at visitors to his office, is a large framed portrait of Dad.
Yes. Warren had a relationship with his father that I would call reverence. And when his father died, he never was able to resolve the grief from that. He placed this portrait at first across from his desk, and now it hangs right over Warren's head. It's the significance of Howard Buffett to Warren is he's always trying to live up to his father's ideals and principles, and that's something that is facing him every time he enters his own office.
Standard issue tycoonery, that I reckon. Now, as a young man, he becomes an apprentice to Benjamin Graham. Who or what was Benjamin Graham?
Benjamin Graham is sometimes known as the Dean of Wall Street. He was the first person to create a fundamental method of security analysis based on the value of a business. And he ran what would be known as a hedge fund today. And Warren studied under him and then went to work for him.
A hedge fund?
Yes, meaning that it went short stocks as well as long. And
well, I know what it means.
Yeah.
I'm just very shocked that Mr. Buffet had anything to do with them, really.
Well, his own partnership, in effect, was a hedge fund. And there were hedge funds back in the day, and there was nothing really unusual about that. But what was true about Warren's was that he didn't charge a management fee. He only made money if his partners made money, and that's different from today.
Alice, tell us about his Siamese twin.
That would be Charlie Munger, his partner, whom he met in 1959. Charlie was also from Omaha, and he has a lot of similarities to Warren in personality, way of thinking about investing. He's quite curmudgeonly, and they differ on certain things like politics, but he was the one who convinced Warren to become more open in his investing approach and look at the quality of companies and not just their price.
Okay, what's with Omaha? What's in the water there? I mean, why is it that Omaha produces these characters?
Well, there's a lot of interesting people from Omaha. Henry Fonda, the actor, came from Omaha, but it's a relatively small city. It has that United States Midwestern value, which is unpretentiousness, honesty, thrift. It's a cultural thing, and Warren loves it there. He's never really happy when he's far away from Omaha.
Does Omaha vote Republican or Democrat? I'm just curious about this.
Well, the city is more liberal than the state, but Nebraska is more Republican than not.
Okay, so Omaha gives Warren his Midwestern niceness and agreeability, you think?
I do. I think some of that was his family, but they all came out of that culture.
Is it true that he has a framed certificate from a Dale Carnegie course?
He calls it the most important degree he ever earned. Yes.
You're kidding.
No.
Well, tell us why.
He was very insecure when he was young and had that fear of public speaking that, you know, there have been surveys that most people fear public speaking more than death. Well, Warren certainly did. And he was so shy that when he had to talk to women, some people told me that he would just grunt. He couldn't, his throat would close up. He couldn't speak. So
I have the same reaction constantly.
Dale Carnegie helped him overcome that, and it was important to him in later life.
I think we should tell the listener, the Gladys and the Poddies, who Dale Carnegie was, because it's a long time since I've heard his name. He wrote a book called How to Win Friends and Influence People. He almost began the whole self-improvement era, didn't he?
He was certainly one of the earliest, and the most important of the self-help authors, yes. And his ideas were don't criticize. The sweetest sound to a person is the sound of their own name. A lot of very common sense ideas, but very influential.
There's a very famous saying, and that is that behind every great fortune is a crime, or a great crime, well known to Mr. Buffett, and he denies its relevance to him.
He does. He says that's not true at Berkshire Hathaway, and as far as I could tell, it isn't true. But what is true is, you've referred to other tycoons, that drive that comes from an unhappy early life, that need to prove yourself, is what's behind Berkshire Hathaway.
Now, Charlie, his Siamese twin, says Warren's whole ego is poured into this company.
He's referred to it as part of himself. I'm all wrapped up in Berkshire Hathaway. It's almost an externalized version of himself. And even its stock price is a measure of himself in a way. So yes, that's very true.
Well, you raise the bar a bit. You describe the company as his Sistine Chapel, not just a work of art, but an illustrated text of his beliefs.
Yes, he thinks of himself as a teacher, and in fact, he would rather that be his legacy than the money. He writes these shareholder letters that people read. They're on the internet, and they're people who are almost obsessive about them. They're very good. They have a lot of wisdom about money and business and other things. And his shareholder meeting is a sort of carnival where this past year, 31,000 people came, and they spend 6 hours listening to Warren and Charlie answer questions.
Now, he's not the most adventurous of capitalists, is he? He looks at businesses that he likes his businesses to be well established and well managed.
He wants something that is predictable and won't become obsolete. So he invests in things like brick companies and housing related things that are very simple, like siding manufacturers. And they make pig stalls, boots, all kinds of very practical, simple things.
Berkshire Hathaway itself had its origins in textiles, I understand.
Unfortunately, yes.
Why
it was a failing business that he bought by mistake, in effect. He bought it because he was angry at the person who ran it and wanted to wrest control of it away from him. And he says, now I wish I'd never heard of Berkshire Hathaway.
You make the point, you stress it in your book, that he doesn't just look at the company, at its profit forecasts. He looks very closely at the managers.
He does now. In his early years, he had to learn to do that by making some mistakes. And his most important criteria for buying a business now, after the business itself, is who's going to run it. Because, as one friend puts it, he delegates to the point of abdication. So he needs somebody who will run it well.
And he didn't think he'd find that, did he, in dot-com companies? He didn't want to put money into internet stocks. And famously, or perhaps infamously, he said 20 years ago, I tell you why I like the cigarette business. It costs a penny to make. It sells for a dollar. It's addictive.
he he agrees with that sentiment. He was quoting a priest who was at Creighton University, who supposedly was the first to say that, but he agreed with the sentiment. He likes businesses like that, that have high profit margins and where the person will just keep buying and buying and buying and buying it.
He invests significantly in media companies. Is this to give him protection or is it to give him leverage? What's the motive?
I would cite a dual motive. He recognized mid-century the power of media to communicate ideas. And, you know, thinking of himself as a teacher, he saw this venue. Also, media has been a very, very profitable business. You mentioned Mr. Murdoch earlier. There are a number of people who've made enormous fortunes in media. It's become less so in recent years, but huge dynasties have been created out of media, and Warren saw that wealth.
I wish you'd buy a few ailing newspapers now as well as helping Goldman Sachs.
You know, he was there early on when it was a profitable business, but now he's passed on all these investments because they are ailing.
Yeah, that's sad because you need people who actually care about media or newspaper businesses to keep them alive and kicking. This annual trek to Nebraska to listen to this extraordinary meeting, they come along, I guess, to hear a Delphic prophet, don't they? They come along to hear someone tell them about tomorrow, and his track record shows an uncanny tendency to be right. For example, he was quite prescient when he called financial derivatives weapons of mass destruction.
That was in 2002, and it reflected in part his chairmanship at Salomon Inc., the investment bank he had worked at and owned part of in the 1990s and back to 87. He has a way of being able to look forward and ask the question, and then what? You know, and then what is going to happen? And he has over and over made these predictions and been right.
Has he made any major predictions and been wrong?
I can't think of any. And I've studied, you know, I've looked for them, and there aren't any. But it's important to note that he doesn't make frequent predictions.
Well, of course, that's the trick for the professional, clairvoyant. They make thousands of predictions, and of course, some of them have to be right, and they're the ones that they emphasise at the end of a given year. It's interesting that this judgment of character that he looks for in businesses he buys into extends to his own. In 34 years, Berkshire has never lost an operating chief except to death.
That's true. And rarely do they ever have to fire anyone. He's been good at selecting people, and he's got a lot of very old managers who've worked there a very long time.
Well, he's getting on a bit himself now. Does he plan to retire?
I think he would have to be tied up and carried out in chains before he would retire. He loves what he's doing.
Yeah. And in the current financial crisis, he sees, and I quote, poetic justice.
Well, you know, there was a lot of greed and poor judgment and rapacity that's led to where we are now. And some of the people who've lost the most money were the ones who were, you know, making it in ways that he didn't approve of, and a lot of people didn't. So, yeah, that's true.
He admits to moments of greed himself, but it's almost whimsical. Let me quote, "A simple rule dictates my buying. Be fearful when others are greedy, and be greedy when others are fearful."
Yes, and he means that the markets are ruled by emotion. And so when investors are panicking, then that's when he likes to buy, and vice versa.
I was surprised at the length and the depth of his friendship with Bill Gates. Both of them seem to have rather troubled personal relationships, or rather, they're not great at being gregarious.
You know, I'm not an expert on Bill Gates. I do know him, so I can't compare as an expert, but, you know, I think that what binds them together is they have a father-son relationship almost. They have a very warm, almost sweet relationship when you see them together, and an intellectual bond. And I think to some extent they both are solitary creatures in their singularity. You know, yeah. They both grew up being the only one of their type, and I think that's a bond.
Well, the bond is so strong that he made that extraordinary decision to donate or to be a philanthropist via Gates. And that is so odd. It's so counterintuitive, or rather it's counter-egotistical.
It is counter-egotistical. It's like Warren in that he's very unconventional, and he will be remembered for doing it, perhaps more than if he had set up a foundation in his own name.
Yes, I was gobsmacked the day it was announced. It's something that tycoons don't do. Okay, let's get on to the private life now. Come closer to the microphone. The only salacious thing about Buffet is that he essentially has two wives, and you deal with this in the book. Would you explain this rather odd setup?
Well, early in his marriage, everything revolved around him and his career, and his wife, Susan, was perfectly fine with that because of her personality. But by the time the children were grown in the 1970s, she wanted a more reciprocal relationship, and she wasn't going to find that with Warren. She moved to San Francisco in 1977 and began, she was pursuing a life of her own at that point, and in effect they both were. He was spending a lot of time with Catherine Graham, the publisher of the Washington Post.
Yep.
But he wasn't living with her, and he is incapable of living without a relationship with a woman. He can't turn on his own oven. And so Susie arranged for one of her friends, Astrid Manx, to come and look in on Warren, and to perhaps most people's unsurprise, they ended up moving in together.
Dear, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. I'm deeply shocked. This is outrageous. I like the fact that his first wife was responsible for changing his politics from his dad's extreme republicanism to Democrat.
Yeah, the civil rights era and Susie's influence were certainly what did that. He had been a lifelong Republican, but by the time his father died in 1964, his views had changed. He did say, however, this is a fascinating influence of his father, that had his father lived, he would not have switched his party because it would have hurt his father. And he said it would have really constrained his life.
He has, or you write in the book about his relationship with his mother, a woman so cruel to him that now in his 70s, he is reduced to tears when telling you about her.
Yes, Leela Buffett was really sort of monstrous toward her children, and yet she had a hard life herself, so it's hard to know, what happened there. But, he never had a relationship with her that could be considered in any way close. He was frightened of her his whole life, and he regrets the opportunity to have ever had a normal relationship with a mother, and he's always looking for mother substitutes in his friends and everyone around him.
Has he belatedly become a decent father?
Yes. He was an absentee father when he was younger, and now he's much closer to his children, and he's much more generous, too.
He's taken a very proactive role in this economic crisis, harking back to the behaviour of many tycoons, of course, like Morgan, back in the Great Depression. He personally bailed out Goldman Sachs. Why?
To make money. It'll be very profitable, or should be, for the investors of Berkshire Hathaway. But, he doesn't invest for civic reasons. He gives advice. And he's been very helpful to some of these companies in telling them how to help themselves. But he would not put a dime in for altruistic reasons. That's not how he thinks.
Let me ask you this in parenthesis. Do you like him?
I do. He is a lot of fun. He's very likable. At the same time, he can be very irritating, and there's times you want to strangle him. But yes, I do like him.
Why does he like Obama?
Well, I don't want to speak for him, so...
Well, I'm sorry, you've got to do that today.
Okay, well, my observation is that, Obama is a believer in reducing social inequality, as is Warren, and would tend to favor policies that would do that. Obama also sought Warren out early on, several years ago, and asked him to help him understand economics. And he's made a concerted effort to learn about business and finance from Warren, which I think is a plus to have a politician who understands that. Most of them don't.
He prides himself on not paying the highest rate of tax. And yet he supports Obama taxing the super rich.
Well, he actually argues that it's a flaw in the system that he pays less tax as a percentage of his earnings than his secretary. And he would raise tax rates on investment earnings because he thinks that it's morally wrong.
He could always slip his secretary a few bob on the side, but still. Alice, thanks for that. Great fun.
Thank you.
Alice Schroeder's little book, which is about 6 foot thick, is called The Snowball, Warren Buffet and the Business of Life, published by Allen and Unwin. Do you remember that wonderful character, Hyacinth Bucket, who insisted on being called Hyacinth Bouquet? I think the same thing should apply to Warren. And this is LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, downloadable onto your pod, The State of Gippsland Lakes.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.